If you have a brain, you have bias. So let's just own it. Some biases help us by simplifying our decision-making process. Other biases hold us back by impacting who gets hired and promoted, and even who we approach to be our friends. Welcome to Breaking the Bias, a podcast where we interview impact makers who are breaking the bias when it comes to inclusion and equity, because sharing our stories is how real belonging happens.
Between 45 and 50 is the low point of life satisfaction for people. And then after 50, people get happier with each ensuing decade. So 60s happier than 50s, 70s happier than 60s. And wow. So it's like, it's a U curve.
Today's topic is a special one. For the first time ever, we have five generations in the workplace. So when we talk about DEI, it's important to also talk about ageism and generational diversity. In today's conversation, Consciously Unbiased founder Ashish Kaushal sits down with Chip Conley, the founder and CEO of Modern Elder Academy. Just a little about Chip. At age 26, he grew a successful boutique hotel company and later became a best-selling author. Then, in his 50s, he joined Airbnb as the head of global hospitality and strategy, where most of his employees were half his age. Today, he is promoting the idea of a modern elder with his latest book, Wisdom at Work. He defines an elder as someone who is as curious as they are wise and is helping to reframe aging as an opportunity for growth. In this episode, Chip shares how a near-death experience changed the way he lives his life, how his work at Airbnb helped him bridge generational divides, and how to hold on to a beginner mindset in midlife and beyond. Now, on to their conversation.
I started a boutique hotel company, one of the first boutique hotel companies in the United States in the mid-1980s, when I was 26 years old. It was called Joie de Vivre, based in San Francisco. We had 52 boutique hotels, each with their own name, around the state of California. And then I loved it for 22 years. And then my last 2 years, I hated it. I didn't want to do it anymore. And everything that could go wrong was going wrong in my life. And I was, in essence, maybe having a little bit of a midlife crisis, which I now call a midlife chrysalis. I think I was just in the dark and gooey cocoon in between caterpillar and butterfly. And long story short is I had an NDE, a near-death experience, when I had an allergic reaction to a strong antibiotic after having broken my ankle and had a bacterial infection in my leg. And that experience woke me up and said, you know what? Do I want to continue to live my life this way? And it's sort of not a bad way to look at your life on a daily basis, although, you know, you don't want to make decisions based upon one bad day, one bad week, or even one bad month. But what I knew for sure was that I had outgrown the identity that was firmly implanted on my body. And I needed to do something new, and I needed to reimagine and repurpose myself. So that led me to selling my company at the bottom of the Great Recession, and which led me to being open to seeing what was next in my early 50s. And that's when I got a call from the three founders of Airbnb 10 years ago, when nobody had ever heard of Airbnb, and they're a small tech startup in San Francisco. And they said, listen, you are a hospitality entrepreneur who knows travel industry well and has run companies. Will you come and help be our in-house mentor? And I did that for 7.5 years, 4 years full-time, 3.5 years as a strategic advisor. So in sum, I sort of saw the worst side of midlife when I was going through my bad period. And then I saw my best part of midlife, which was in my 50s, when I saw how you can be relevant and how intergenerational collaboration in the workplace can be incredibly energizing. And so that's my story is I know that midlife can be bad. I also know that it can be good.
So let's unpack that, because I think there's a few pieces to that. One is, I read somewhere that you had said that you passed away nine times when you had that situation. So can you go more into that a little bit? Because I'd love to hear a little bit more detail on that.
And you want the juicy details. I was giving a speech in St. Louis. I should have been at home under the covers, because I was on crutches, and I had a bacterial infection in my leg. And I was on a strong antibiotic. At the end of my speech, I sat and signed books. I like to write books. And so I had written a book called Peak just before that. Mm-hmm. And so I was signing books and I, you know, just slumped in my chair in the middle of signing books. And they put me on the ground and I ended up on the ground for about 5 minutes, unconscious, came conscious right around the time that the paramedic showed up. Fortunately, there was a paramedic station really close. And when they put me on the gurney, they, for the first time, my heart stopped. Mm-hmm. And they had to get the paddles out and shock me back to life. And over the next 90 minutes in getting me to the hospital, being in the emergency room, they kept shocking me back to life. And what I saw on the other side of that, is that what you want to know as well? Mm-hmm. On the other side of that, I was like this, like almost like an angel flying, just fluttering my wings in the middle of a big living room in a mountain chalet where there was light coming through a sunroof or skylight and projecting like a kaleidoscope of colors on the wall. And there was this beautiful, viscous, very thick oil, smells like frangipani, like a tropically scented oil that was slowly going across the beautiful wood floor and then down the stairs. And so long story short is every time I came back from being on the other side and having no heart rate, I would say to the nurse, I would tell her, this is what I just saw. And she said, well, that's what you said last time. So I kept having the same vision. There were no other people there, but there were birds everywhere. Birds were flying with me, you know, in this sort of idyllic paradise. But yeah, that was my experience. And what I took from it, interestingly enough, you know, what I took from it, this was 2008 when it happened. 3 years earlier, I had created with my company a hotel called the Hotel Vitale in San Francisco, you know, on the waterfront in the right across the street from the Farmers Market and Ferry Building. Yeah. And we had these slippers in that hotel, that luxury hotel, that said slow on one slipper and down on the other. And I think what I took from this experience was my NDE was very slow motion. Mm-hmm. And everything was happening very slowly. And I was like, okay, I need to slow down. And I hadn't had a heart attack and there was just nothing related to like slowing down because of my heart. But it had everything to do with realizing that my lifestyle was very sped up. Mm-hmm. And so that's been an ongoing lesson, 14 years later.
And so it's interesting because you went through a life-changing experience and a lot of us would have come out of that and sort of been depressed and said, you know, I'm like crippled on some level and I just couldn't get out of our own way. But you took it as, and this kind of like the story where you started and then we went into this, it takes me back is essentially at the core of it, you're very curious and you're very entrepreneurial. And so instead of saying, I'm going to let this problem define me, I'm going to redefine the problem and try to solve it.
Well, the part that was really interesting is that there's a book that I'd been reading that was in my day bag that was in the hospital with me. And it's Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Mm-hmm. Very famous book about a Jewish psychologist who ends up in a concentration camp in World War II. And if you were to distill that powerful book on meaning, Man's Search for Meaning, down to an equation, the equation is despair equals suffering minus meaning. When I ended up in ICU and then in my hospital room, when they were trying to figure out what was wrong with me, I had that book with me. And I distilled that book down to an emotional equation of despair equals suffering minus meaning. And that became my anthem for the next few years, and for the rest of my life, frankly, but especially for the next 2 years, like, how do I have less despair by creating more meaning? Assuming suffering is ever present, which is a philosophy that comes from Buddhism, but first noble truth of Buddhism. But what would it be like if I actually, even in the worst of times, focused on the lesson, learning, or meaning? And that's what I did from that experience.
I love that. I actually just wrote that down because I was like, that's a really good saying and a way to look at things and live things. So in terms of lessons learned and also just sort of continuing that journey, like how did you make sure that turned into a habit instead of like, okay, I went through this experience, I'm going to change how I behave and change some of the things I do in my life, and then 3 months later you kind of go back to the way things are normally? Like, how did you make sure that was part of the formula of consistency?
Well, one of the things, so I've I'm a longtime meditator, so been doing it for 40 years now. And so I really reintegrated meditation in my life. Mm-hmm. Viktor Frankl said, between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is your power to choose your response. And in your response lies your growth and your freedom. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, how do I create some more space between stimulus and response? And meditation was one way of doing that. I also would reflect each week, at the end of each week, on what was my key lesson of the week, my mm-hmm. meaning of the week, so that I was metabolizing my meaning. And that helped. And I also just asked for help from friends, you know, friends and family, yeah. just to say, hold me accountable.
I love that. And Consciously Unbiased, you talk about a accountability partner. If you want to change a habit, you kind of have to make sure that you have somebody in your life that's in your life in a consistent manner. They can actually see what you're doing instead of you reporting saying, I did this week. They're like, no, actually, you didn't do this week. You know, but they have right. to know you want to hold you accountable. So let's go to unpacking ageism. Like, how do you define a definition of success that evolves in an elder compared to when someone who's in their younger days?
So I think I'm a big fan of Carl Jung's work as the famous psychologist. And there's a guy named Richard Rohr, who's a famous Christian mystic, who has come to MEA as the Modern Elder Academy as a student. So what I will say is that both of them said the same thing, which is that the primary operating system for the first half of our adult life is our ego. It's what propels us forward. It's what individuates us. And it can be a very positive thing, but it also can be negative if it gets out of control. Yeah. But they also both said that around midlife is when you realize that there's a primary operating system change and it's moving from the ego to the soul. Mm-hmm. And so I would say no, but most of us have no operating manual for how do you now drive this new operating system of the soul. So long story short is for me, what became really apparent is the success script that I had, you know, lived during my 20s, 30s, and 40s was very much ego driven. And it served me well in many ways, but by the time I got to the point where I sold my company at the bottom of the Great Recession, and I didn't want to do it anymore after having been CEO for 24 years, I realized that there was something much deeper and more meaningful I was looking for in my life. And I now can look back and say, wow, I was having this operating system change. So success since that time, so I'm 62 now. So for the last dozen years, the success has really been more about, you know, how am I serving? Who am I serving? How am I serving them? And to quote Erik Erikson, famous developmental psychologist, I am what survives me. Mm-hmm. So what will survive me? You know, what is it that I will be able to offer to the world that is going to live beyond me? And so often so much of that is the relationships we build. And for me, a lot of the success that I define today comes from who I mentor, who I support, to help them be more successful in their lives.
I love that. I always say, and I'm sure I took this from somebody, but life's about the journey, not the destination. We all end up at the same place, but it's how you get there, which is what people remember and the memories you make and the impact you make in society. Can you share an example of something that really sticks in your mind that you learned from a younger person at work and a lesson you learned from as an elder person at work?
Sure. When I joined Airbnb with the founders, I thought, okay, well, they brought me in as the mentor, so I guess I'm supposed to be the wise one. And very quickly, I learned, oh my God, I'm not just the wise one. I'm also the dumb one, because I was 52 years old. I never worked in a tech company before. So I have learned a lot of DQ, digital intelligence, from younger people, and especially during my time at Airbnb, learning about, you know, how to create a compelling website, how to use functionality on my iPhone that I'd never used before, how to understand, you know, the customer journey when it comes to a digital relationship. So all those things are things I learned from younger people. What I've learned from older people and, you know, elders along the way is usually that at the end of the day, the people who you most admire, mm-hmm. who've been a mentor of yours, are people who may have great knowledge and they may have great skills, but the ones that you most remember and most admire are the ones who taught you character qualities. So as David Brooks famously wrote in a New York Times op-ed, it's not the resume you look at, it's the eulogy. You know, what will people say at your eulogy? And so I think along the way, I've gotten really great advice about how to become a more emotionally intelligent leader, and typically from people older than me.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think that's part of the thing that's missing in today's like DQ digital intelligence workplace, is that they're not tapping into the wisdom of older generations and also sort of hiding behind this digital platform and not having that human interaction that builds the bond for creativity?
Yeah. There's no doubt. There's a lot you just said there. One is, yes, in the COVID era we've been in and everybody's doing things by means of video conferencing, something gets lost. And so, so as a leader or an emotionally intelligent person in an organization, you need to say, how do I integrate humanity back into the relationship? Because Zoom is a very transactional technology. So that's the first point. Number two is, yes, a lot of organizations need to look at how do they develop age diversity, but this goes in both directions. It's like old school manufacturing companies or law firms or things that where the hierarchy tends to be top down from old to young. Mm-hmm. And the young people get all the shit that they have to do, excuse the expression. Excuse the word. And so there's that, and they could use age diversity because those older people in those organizations might actually learn something from the younger people. Mm-hmm. But in Silicon Valley, what's very clear to me based on my experience is like, wow, you have these young people, often millennials, but sometimes Gen Z even, who are getting funded for huge amounts of money from venture capitalists to go create these ventures. And the young people may have a beautiful idea. They may be a brilliant technologist, but they've never run a company before. They've never understood, you know, what I would call process knowledge. How do you get things done in an organization? And so there's a lot of opportunity. I was the modern elder. The founders called me a modern elder. I didn't like that at first, but they said, Chip, a modern elder is someone who's as curious as they are wise. It's like, okay, if that's what a modern elder is, I will be the modern elder here.
I love that.
What they really wanted and needed was my wisdom more mm-hmm. than anything. And so how do we create organizations where a young technologist says, man, just like Brian Chesky, the CEO, I need Chip to be my in-house mentor and to run certain functions of the company, even though he's 21 years my senior and he's double the age of the average person in the company. Mm-hmm. He also had to have enough courage and confidence to know that he was going to continue to be CEO. My job was not to come in and take his job.
Yeah.
And he had to be humble enough to say, I want to learn a lot here, because often it's hubris that actually raises the money from venture capitalists, absolutely. But it's humility that runs the organization. And so that was a beautiful experience. And I think, you know, there's a lot of good examples of flameouts where, you know, at Uber or WeWork or Theranos, those three leaders, Travis, Adam, and Elizabeth, all could have used a modern elder by their side, or at least a modern elder that they were listening to by their side. Because I do believe that much of what went on there was, you know, frankly, neophyte in terms of ego and bravado and maybe even integrity.
No, absolutely. I mean, I you kind of triggered two things for me in that discussion. One was, looking back, I think the smartest I ever was when I was 19 years old in college. Because you don't know what you don't know, and you're mentally challenged, and you don't, and then the rest of your journey in your life is you accomplish more things, but you realize how much you don't know as you get older, right? And there's a value in that, because that's actually how you improve, and so your mind opens up. And the second thing was, I don't know if you remember this, but when you're in high school, you're like 18 or 17, and you're in the best shape of your life, and your dad's like older than you, and you think you're stronger than him, and so you play wrestle with him, and you realize that even though he's not as good shape as you, he's got old man strength, and that technique and that wisdom around that is not just the muscle you have, it's actually how you use that and apply it. And I think we all need to be reminded of that, especially when we're entrepreneurs at 25 years old and we raise $100 million and we think we're invincible, but you don't realize what you don't realize. And that having an elder person with you on that journey that you respect and listen to, I think will make you successful.
And the key is to be a mentor and an intern at the same time, and mutual mentorship. And that this idea of, because yes, you could have the old gray hair in the room, but there's a missed opportunity for that gray hair in the room if they're not actually learning from the younger people as well. So that's the mutual mentorship is important. And there's a lot of data on this. I mean, a lot of, about the value of age diversity as well.
Now, so speaking of that, the modern workplace has five generations working together. How do we bridge the existing generational borders and increase collaboration?
So first of all, we have to show the value of it. So there's been a number of studies out of Germany. Germany has an older workforce than the US, and in fact, Europe does generally. And so they've been studying age diversity more than the US has. And what they've shown is that when you have a team that's exclusively young people, they make decisions quickly and they make a lot of mistakes. Mm-hmm. When you have a decision that is exclusively older people, it takes them longer to make decisions and they make less mistakes. Mm-hmm. But when you combine older and younger people on the same team, it's the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. So you get decisions are made expeditiously, less mistakes are made. Mm-hmm. Now, why is that? Part of the reason for that is because the young brain and the older brain are actually different. And we know that the older, there's like flaws with the older brain because short-term memory is not as good. But as Arthur Brooks wrote about in his New York Times bestselling book in February called From Strength to Strength, one of the things that gets better with age is not fluid intelligence, which is very focused, linear, which is something we're really good at when we're young. But what gets better with age is systemic crystallized intelligence. And that is the ability to connect the dots and think holistically. So if you have a team full of focused, let's call them, let's just say technologists who are exceptional at being bright and quick, along with some older people who think more holistically and have peripheral vision to mm-hmm. see around the corner, because that is one of the challenges often with a younger person is they don't know the implications of the decisions they're making. So they don't, whereas an older person has more pattern recognition, which is a form of wisdom, to say, if we make this set of decisions, this is where we're going to look like, this is what it's going to look like 6 months from now. And mm-hmm. and they have that wisdom partly based upon the metabolized experience that they've had in their life. So you combine that together and you get the best of both worlds. So to answer your question, we just need more data and more case studies that show this kind of age diversity is just as important of a form of diversity as is race, you know, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. And unfortunately, only 8% of the Fortune 1000 companies in the world have actually added age diversity as an important metric that's on the same level as those other demographic metrics.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one that's definitely been overlooked because we're looking at the black versus white and then transgender and all the other things, but we never really looked at age diversity. And it's funny, when I actually started Consciously Unbiased, the idea was to build equality and inclusion in the workplace in a meaningful way. And the two things we always talked about is measuring at the micro level rather than the macro level. Because if you want ROI and diversity, you actually have to get diversity of thought. And the way you get diversity of thought is to look at each team, not look at, oh, I have 30% women in my organization, so I've hit diversity, but they're all marketing and all my engineers are Indian and all my finance people might be Asian. You built three countries inside your company, and so you're not getting the ROI and diversity. But if you do it at the micro level, then everyone's included, including the white male, right? So if you, like, for example, in engineering, a white male is a minority candidate. And so if you make space for everybody and realize no one has a monopoly on discrimination or ideas, then you become a more powerful organization. So speaking of, like, in terms of practical examples, you went into Airbnb in a tech company where you had industry knowledge of the industry they're trying to break into, but they had the tech knowledge. So how did they make space, or how did you make space to make sure that people's voices are heard, vice versa? Like, what are some practical techniques we can use within an organization or a meeting?
Let me say that, you know, looking at, so there's a company called Atlassian. Atlassian's Australian-based software company. Yeah. And they have actually taken their age diversity so seriously that they have metrics that show what level of age diversity they have across all of their functional teams in the company. Mm-hmm. So as you're saying earlier, instead of sort of, you know, saying, oh, here's the macro, no, they actually look at it on the micro, because what they believe is actually on a team, having that age diversity is important. Because if you have all, you know, if you just have all the young people over there and all the old people over there, you're not actually getting the benefit of it. Yeah. So I would just say that's number one. Number two is, how on those teams do you create sub-teams where you have collaborators who are often across generations. So, you know, I on my team, I ran a bunch of the teams at Airbnb, but across my teams, I liked trying to create, like, let's say there's an initiative we were working on, and I had a Gen Xer, an older Gen Xer, and a younger millennial leading that team. That felt good to me when I was doing, because that team then has the diversity of people, not just at the conversation level, but actually at the sort of scoping level of how they're operating. So I think that's key. And I think, you know, at company events, profiling cross-generational relationships and partnerships has been really effective as well.
Mm. What about terminology and vernacular? I had an intern that I had dinner with recently, and she was describing all these terms that no longer are acceptable in society. And most of them were actually things I would probably use when I was a kid, like in high school, right? Slang and things like that. And so I was like, you can't cancel everything just because somebody says something, and you have to look at the context and the meaning behind it versus just the word today, because none of them knows the historical origination of everything. And so if you have an elder in a meeting with a millennial and they're quote both trying to get to the same place, but one doesn't use terminology, the other, how do we create an environment where we have permission to be honest, but not jump from a conclusion of discrimination?
Well, I think we have to assume best intentions. So if you have an organization where it's almost like a value in the organization, that it's so unusual in the world today, especially in the social media world and the political world, we do not assume best intentions. But to actually create a workplace where you assume best intentions, I think that is a great leveling force. So that if, let's say, the boomer says something in the meeting that feels like, wow, that just feels archaic, we don't use that language anymore, instead of lecturing that person in the meeting that was a mistake, you know, someone pulls them aside after the meeting and says, you know, here's how some people might have taken that. But it comes from that, you know, pulling them aside afterwards is coming from an assuming best intentions. So the only way that works is if you hire people who fit that profile of assuming best intentions and appreciating a certain amount of cultural curiosity. So curiosity is another important quality for organizations. So judgment is the opposite of curiosity. Curiosity is not always efficient. Judgment is fast, and it's an indictment typically. Curiosity is sort of like opening up possibilities, but it isn't efficient. But there's times when that is exactly what's necessary, is curiosity. So I would just say, assuming best intentions, developing a curious culture, those kinds of things will help to create a more culturally curious citizenry within a company, and, you know, maybe more empathy and compassion in the conversations that are going on.
I love that. So how's the Modern Elder Academy helping to reframe midlife from a crisis to a calling?
So my experience at Airbnb was so phenomenal in terms of, like, wow, I can see the value of intergenerational collaboration. I could also see how in your 50s, you can still be relevant. I lost 5 friends during the Great Recession to suicide, all men, aged 42 to 52. And this was, again, during 2008 to 2010. And so there's a part of me that felt like, after that happened, then I joined Airbnb. I went through my own tough time that, you know, when I had my NDE around that same time. So it's like, I was writing this book called Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. I was writing it down here in Southern Baja, about an hour north of Cabo San Lucas at a beachfront home. And I was like, hey, Chip, why is there no such thing as a midlife wisdom school? Why is there not a place for people actually repurpose and reimagine themselves? And using what I learned at Airbnb. So the Modern Elder Academy, MEA, got hatched out of that. That was 5 years ago. We now have 3,000 alumni from 40 countries, 26 regional chapters around the world. And the whole premise is, how do you create a place where people are actually almost like going to a prep school for elderhood? You know, in high school, people go to prep school or they can go to public school too. I went to public school, but some people go to prep school to prep for college, but you're also prepping for adulthood. Mm-hmm. But in midlife, we have very little in the way of rites of passage or rituals to help people to prep for the latter part of their life. And you may be, you know, by the way, elder is a relative term. It's not elderly. It's like a stage. It's a stage of life. If you're a Silicon Valley software engineer, you might be an elder, a modern elder at 35, based upon who you're surrounded by. So long story short is we started it and it's been hugely successful. And we do online programs as well as workshops here in Baja on a beachfront campus. And then we have two campuses opening in Santa Fe, New Mexico in the next 2 years.
I love that. I just remember growing up when people hit their 40s, people joke about you're in your midlife crisis. And it wasn't really like a support system. It was more like you're feeling guilty that your life's half over. And I think your life's kind of actually in the trajectory upwards after that, because you're actually doing things that are important and creating your legacy on some level, the second half of your life.
The U-curve of happiness, so social science research that's pretty important, it shows that generally speaking, on average, across all cultures except for Russia has an aberration on this, is between 45 and 50 is the low point of life satisfaction for people. Mm-hmm. And then after 50, people get happier with each ensuing decade. So 60s happier than 50s, 70s happier than 60s. And wow. So it's like, it's a U curve. So, you know, unhappiness from 22 down to 45 to 50, and then up to 75 to 80. And the last couple of years of life, sometimes people have a drop in happiness. So it's a U curve. So bottom line is, how are we helping society to understand that the societal message on aging is like, okay, if you can get through your midlife crisis, on the other side of that, you've got disease, decrepitude, and death. But in fact, it's not that way. In fact, on the other side of that, the personal narrative is like your best years of your life are often after age 50. So how do we help people to see that? And then how do we help elevate people in that era of their life to realize how many options they have available to themselves? So, and we're living in an era where more and more people want to work longer, sometimes by choice, but a lot of times by necessity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're going to see the average retirement age in the next 20 years grow from early 60s to late 60s or early 70s. So we better be prepared for that. And in fact, the U.S. Department of Labor has shown that between 2016 and 2026, almost half of the growth in the labor supply is going to actually come from people 55 and older. And it's because fewer of them are actually retiring, and more of them are coming back into the workplace after having retired. Mm-hmm. And of course, the boomer demographic is a huge demographic. So long story short is the growth, more and more companies need to start thinking about like, okay, we're going to go do some serious recruiting. How might we recruit people 50 and older? Now, when you think of that, it's like, oh, well, they're going to be old and crotchety. They're going to like not have to be open to new experiences and learning something new. They're going to be expensive. And you know, these are myths, and some myths actually have some accuracy to them, but they definitely don't apply across all people, especially the one about, you know, costing more money. Yeah, as you get older, often your salary increases, but actually peak earnings for people tends to be around age 50. Generally speaking, after age 50, people's salaries start to actually either flatline or go down, sometimes because they go into a new industry. And there's a growing number of people who actually don't want to work 5 days a week or full time. So take a person who is like a senior executive making $200,000 a year, and they say, I want to work 3 days a week. Well, guess what? You know, 60% of $200,000 a year is $120,000 a year. That senior executive, you could get all the benefit of having them in the trenches with you for 3 days a week, and you pay them 60% of what they normally get paid. And so all of a sudden that becomes a bargain.
Absolutely. No, definitely. My friend actually went to your academy, and I think I was telling you this before, that it was life-changing for him because it actually changed his perspective on what's really important to him and how he wants to live his future. And it's really kind of given balance both on his career and his health. 15% of people who come to the academy are millennials. Can you share why that's happening? I think you touched on a little bit with the tech entrepreneurs.
But yeah, it's been really interesting because, you know, you call a program Modern Elder Academy, and you don't expect millennials to be showing up. But in fact, with 15% of our alumni are millennials. Why is that? Well, we're also a midlife wisdom school. So we're a place where people come to cultivate and harvest their wisdom. And I would say that, you know, we live in an era where there, you know, almost everybody's a knowledge worker today. That term did not exist until 1959 when Peter Drucker coined it. But I think there's a growing number of people who want to be a wisdom worker at any age. And yeah. What does that mean? It means that they, you know, we live in an era where all of the world's knowledge is in that little, you know, magic, you know, device in your pocket. So you have all the world's knowledge is all organized by Google, but what we're starved for is wisdom. And so how do people learn how to develop their wisdom? And that is really part of what we do here. We also help people to reframe their relationship with aging, which helps people to realize, wow, at age 45, if I'm going to live till 90, yeah, I'm halfway through my life if you start at age zero. But if you look at, I'm 45 and I'm going to live to 90, if you start counting at age 18 when you're an adult or when you started at a career maybe even or started college or whatever, you only have 27 years of adulthood behind you and you have 45 years of adulthood ahead of you. If you do the math on that, you're like only maybe a third or of the way or, you know, a third of the way through your adult life or a third of the way or maybe 40% of the way through your adult life at age 45. You know, people are like, what? Oh, so yeah. So a lot of people who are younger are getting on the bandwagon to say, how do I accelerate my wisdom? How do I help myself make a transition in my career in my 30s, let's say, where I want to go to do something very different? And MEA helps people with transitions. And so it's been beautiful. And it's just a joy to have a workshop full of 20 people with people as young as 28 and as old as 88 in the room together.
So I remember looking back at when I was 30, I was going through this mid-youth crisis where I was like, what am I doing and why am I doing it? And there's got to be more than just making dollars, you know, and impacting society. And so do you think on some level, the amount of information we're getting on our phones in the digital era is sort of aging our brains faster?
I would say what it's doing is, you know, anything, any technology, and going back to the creation of the wheel, any technology that actually takes us away from body functions that we've been used to historically makes that body function more obsolescent. So learning how to write cursive, you know, was something I used to be really good at, but like now it's all, you know, a keyboard. Yeah. And actually I can actually create cursive just using a keyboard. But if I had to write cursive, I'm less good at it today than I used to be. Yeah. Similarly, Google has helped create an environment where the process of doing research is very different than it used to be. And the process of having to remember something is different. So I do think technology has left us in a situation where our brains may be less effective at some things. But I actually think what it means is our brain can be more effective at some other things that technology doesn't give us. So what about things like humility or innovation or intuition or empathy? I don't learn those things from Google, but I do grok those things with my brain and my heart. And so I do think that there's a real opportunity to see that, especially with artificial intelligence as a greater part of our lives, is it true that in fact, artificial intelligence may give us more space in our brain to focus on the human qualities as opposed to the more robotic qualities that our brains have historically been used for?
I want to go back to your Elder Academy a little bit. So you think that part of the reason it's successful is because you're sort of making us exercise all those things we don't use in our brain physically and mentally.
Yeah.
Through the process.
Yes.
I can't write cursive anymore. Like you said, because I'm not used to it anymore. So, and same with relationships, probably on some level.
For sure. I mean, it is like a huge dose in being a human again and building skills that are sort of classic emotional intelligence skills, but also building skills of being a beginner again. And I think one of the challenges for a lot of people as we get older is we only want to play games that we can win. And if that's true, then your sandbox gets smaller and smaller. So one of the things we really help people with is like, oh, they didn't come here expecting to become a beginner again on a bunch of things, but that's part of how our curriculum has been created, and it allows people to sort of say, okay, how am I less judgmental toward myself in trying something new? Yes. Because that's a really important part of creating a long, good life. We call it long life learning, not lifelong learning, mm-hmm. because helping people to learn how to live a more deep and meaningful life is part of what our program's about. And deep and meaningful life is very much something that you use that right hemisphere of your brain on. That's the other thing that's interesting. A lot of people don't know about as we get older is not only are you better at crystallized intelligence, but as we get older, our brain shrinks a little bit. And while it shrinks, what we get better at is being able to move from left brain to right brain more adeptly. Mm. So it's like four-wheel drive of the brain. So you can move from logical to lyrical all in the same sentence. Yeah. And that is a quality that is really valuable. Let me just use an example. At Airbnb, after I'd been there about a month, Brian pulled me aside and said, I want you to be in charge of strategy for the company. And I was already in charge of a bunch of other things. And he said, I want you to be in charge of strategy. And I said, well, I've never been in charge of strategy for a tech company before. So I've never been in a tech company. So do you want me to be, tell me why you want me to be head of strategy? And he basically said to me, I like how your brain works. You are able to sort of see behind, you're able to see a lot of things and take both your left brain and your right brain and apply it to a problem. And some people are just really good at one side or the other. You're good at both sides. And that was a confirmation that this four-wheel drive of the brain thing is something we can get better at as we age.
I love that. And is there anything else important that you'd like to add that I haven't asked you today?
We have modernelderacademy.com. There's chipconley.com. But I would say that the number one place a person could actually learn more about just our point of view is I have a daily blog called Wisdom Well. And Wisdom Well is, if you just look Chip Conley Wisdom Well on Google, you'll find it. It's also on the MEA website. And Wisdom Well is my daily blog that allows people to sort of get a sense of a little microdose of wisdom each day. And so I highly recommend people check it out.
Okay, that sounds great. This is an amazing discussion. I really enjoyed it. And I hope we can get you back again to do some more discussions with us. I wanted to leave you with one question on our side. We have this thing called microprogressions, and they're active steps you can take to make a work environment or a personal environment more inclusive, that consciously unbiased. So can you think of one microprogression that leaders can, at all levels can give to help overcome bias or ageism at work?
Yeah, I think the first step is quantifying it, understanding where it is, and then helping to develop relationships within an organization that are across the generations and, you know, coming from that place of assuming best intentions. So I think that's, I said it earlier and I'll just say it again. We do have something called Generations Over Dinner that is a program that we, you know, that if people want to learn more about that, it's on the MEA website, but it's also generationsoverdinner.com. It is a global initiative that we've started oriented toward bringing 3, 4, 5, maybe as many as 7 generations to a dinner. We've actually had a Generations Over Dinner with 7 generations at the dinner in Australia, in Sydney recently, and one in Denver. And then you go through a series of questions that allow for a bunch of people of different ages to explore topics that are deep and meaningful. So check it out. You can host it at your own home with people you know, and it's a great way to create some more intergenerational collaboration.
You can learn more about our guests and get show notes at consciouslyunbiased.com/listen. And we want to hear from you. Please subscribe and rate Breaking the Bias on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to our podcasts. And drop us a note to let us know if there is a topic you really want to hear about or a guest you want to have on the show. Thanks for listening to Breaking the Bias.